classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
Studenti sono usciti in piazza.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their job.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli occupation has denied COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israeli parliament said Palestinians living under Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip will receive no vaccine. Palestinians say the move is aimed at pressurizing resistance groups to release Israeli soldiers arrested during the Israeli aggression imposed against the Strip since 2014.
Israel's aggressive policies are unacceptable, and Palestinians will resist these inhumane policies. The Israeli announcement to deny vaccines to Gaza is totally unacceptable. The resistance groups will remain steadfast in their fight against the occupation and have prepared themselves for all possible scenarios.
This comes as Israeli Health Ministry has said over a quarter of Israel's population have received the vaccine since December 19. Human rights groups have accused Israeli regime of violating the basic rights of Palestinians.
Since the coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime has sought through all possible means to pressurize the resistance groups into sitting back. Israel has announced that no aid is allowed in the Gaza Strip without the release of their captured soldiers. Palestinians will never accept such a thing, and the Israeli occupation knows this well. Israel is now showing its racist face to the world by announcing this illegal and inhumane policy.
For their own part, Palestinian resistance groups in the Strip have said they will not sit back, adding release of Israeli soldiers should come through a just prisoner swap deal.
We announced that the Israeli attempts to pressurize the resistance front into releasing its captured soldiers won't succeed. We are after a fair swap deal. We won't give in to pressure. Israel's attempts to tie vaccine entrance to soldier release will fail.
Earlier, the United Nations called on the Israeli regime to help ensure Palestinians will receive COVID-19 vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic, stressing that the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN said the cost of lives and livelihoods there remain high, particularly in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's move to deny vaccine to the Palestinians comes as over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with coronavirus and more than 1,800 have lost their lives so far. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. but nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before in the early 1990s as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is a spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the niqab ban to be passed.
A representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted to the ballot, and a recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things, and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favour of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
The American aggression and the blockade on Yemen are terrorist crimes is the motto of a press conference held by the Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and the Children. The conference highlighted the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children and women with American support.
The crimes and violations committed by the U.S. against the people of Yemen are too many and cannot be counted. There is, for example, the crime of targeting children in Dahyan in Sada, and the crime of targeting women in weddings in Wajiha, Ahrab, and Samban, and these are war crimes for sure.
The Minister of Human Rights said that designating Ansarullah as a terrorist organization confirms that the American participation went beyond arms sales, military and logistical support, and reached providing political cover and justifying the crimes of its Saudi ally.
The classification of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is an American green light for Saudi Arabia to continue its aggression against Yemen and also to feed terrorism and terrorist groups, as happened in Al-Baidah. When the Yemeni army found weapons with the logo of the United States Agency for International Development and also for the sake of covering and evading its crimes in Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions of others. The country is suffering from a humanitarian situation that was described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis unanimously agree that the U.S. is a major complicit in the war crimes committed against Yemeni children and women, which necessitates placing its name on the top of the list of states sponsoring terrorism. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
Italy's government decision to block exports of arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates over the ongoing bloodshed in Yemen has been hailed by activists and several Italian lawmakers. The move comes after 2 years of parliamentary activity and lobbying by humanitarian organizations. In 2018, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte indicated his government's intention to end arms sales to Riyadh over its involvement in the onslaught on Yemen and the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Let me start by saying that this is a historic achievement. I and Ms. Quartapelle were the first signatories of a resolution that has permanently revoked approval for arms exports to Saudi Arabia and UAE. This is a clear message of peace coming from our country.
The government did the right thing, even though its decision will affect about 200 workers from a German factory located in the depressed Italian region. The German weapons maker is to sue our country over the decision to stop all arms exports to Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, a blockade should have been already imposed long ago.
The government's decision will halt the sale of almost 13,000 Italian-made missiles to Saudi Arabia. The blocked sales were part of total export of 20,000 missiles worth over 400 million euros agreed in 2016 under the government headed by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Renzi is currently facing criticism for participating in Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiative conference and holding a conversation with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, during which he described the prince as his friend. He has said the monarchy could be the place of a new renaissance for the future.
Matteo Renzi's reputation in politics is one of ruthlessness. In 2014, he pledged then Prime Minister and fellow party member Enrico Letta that he wouldn't anyhow hinder the government, only to shortly afterward orchestrate Letta's downfall. Renzi then became Prime Minister himself. About 2 weeks ago, Renzi triggered the government crisis by abruptly pulling his small Italia Viva party out of the ruling coalition.
According to Italian media, Renzi earns $80,000 a year as a member of Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiative's advisory board. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in November of last year, a controversial bill was drafted in France which would prevent journalists from filming police during arrests. Now, people have regularly taken to the streets in Paris and other cities to demand that the law does not come into effect this January. Will protesters be able to keep this from becoming law, and what they say would take away the checks and balances to help prevent police abuse and brutality? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized the protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
French people have been the victim of police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. We must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a lot of years now in France a lot of discussions about identity checks, which are very more likely to be happening to young people, to men, and to men with different backgrounds from origin, Arabic people and black people. So this kind of systematic background checks and identity checks, it participates to a state racism in French, especially about the police, and so we are fully supporting the Amnesty report.
Last week, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other rights groups warned that they will file a lawsuit against the French government for what they called systematic discrimination by police officers carrying out identity checks. Even French President Macron admitted recently that there was a problem of discrimination during identity checks.
The new security bill will be debated in the French Senate in about 1 month. Some senators declared they want to rewrite the bill, but most protesters here simply want to abrogate it. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, and out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Raza Kazem. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in New York. And Daniel, I mean, why do you think the French government has proposed such a law at this time?
Macron is under great pressure from the far right, from the National Front of Marine Le Pen. In order to hold her off, he's adopted a policy of trying to co-opt her program by toughening up the police and toughening up state responses to protests and demonstrators. And using generally more punitive measures. I mean, France is feeling the strain of COVID, the pandemic, and a severe, savage economic contraction. tempers are rubbed raw, conflict is rising, and the state feels it has no choice but to respond in a militant manner, and that's the only way Macron knows to hold off the challenge from those even further to the right.
Well, what about that, Reza? I mean, Daniel said tempers right now are raw, it's sensitive, they're under a lot of pressure, but as a matter of fact, isn't that even more of a reason to make sure that there are checks and balances on things in France?
I think one of the things that is happening with this particular law is this whole idea of making sure that any police brutality that's carried out is not going to be filmed. And this is particularly something that is conducive or signals that what we're seeing is the emergence of a police state and the different powers that it actually has as a result of it. Because if you don't, on the other hand, we've seen also that many police authorities, police people on the streets and on the front lines are actually carrying cameras and so on in which they can film what's actually going on. And this allows for making sure for there to be accountability. What we're seeing with this is that that accountability will be selectively chosen, and where needed, evidence can be disposed of by the police officers if need be. And in this particular case, what we're talking about is a serious infringement on rights. It's not just about the fact that it's there's a lot of pressure and so on. We've seen this kind of deliberate move over years and decades in this direction. What we're seeing also is that this is something that is very much reminiscent of what used to happen and what was certainly talked about in terms of happening in the Soviet Union kind of spheres of influence, in particular the Stasi police state of East Germany. And so what we're seeing is very much a reemergence of some of those ideas and some of those actual things being put in place. Mm-hmm. And it's got a label of democracy on top of it to try and sweeten what is actually being done. So I think there are some serious issues that are there, and France needs to be called out for what it is, that it is going in the direction of a police state. And that's what it's about.
Well, Daniel, I mean, during this period of great dissatisfaction of the French people towards their government, doesn't this type of law simply make the Macron government even less popular than it already is? I know you talked about trying to appeal to the far right and Le Pen and those who follow her, but in general, as far as looking at the overall French electorate, couldn't this be dangerous for the government itself?
It certainly could be, yes, but I think the that Macron believes he has more to gain than to lose through this kind of policy. He's trying to appeal to the conservative part of the French electorate, which is fed up with disorders in the streets, wants a tougher police response, and if it doesn't get it from Macron, it'll turn to the National Front and Marine Le Pen. So that's the game Macron is playing. He's trying to carve out a base for himself in an angry right of center electorate, and he's hoping to succeed. So we'll see what happens. But unfortunately, if Macron loses, we could very easily see power slip into the hands of the National Front, and that would be, of course, an even greater disaster. Not that I'm trying to make excuses for Macron or in any way justify his policies, because I'm not.
Okay. Well, Reza, immediately following the proposal of this law back in November, a video went viral in France showing a black music producer being brutalized by French police. Do you think that this has played any role in getting more people on the streets to protest against this law? And what could have happened in that same case if there had not been any film of the situation?
I think to answer your first question, it's quite clear that in any kind of law enforcement situation where there is no evidence to suggest and there's no one from within the police who were involved in that process of brutalizing an individual that they are seeking to arrest or seeking to question or whatever, then the police inevitably have backed each other's stance or have gone quiet and not said anything against their own colleague in terms of the repercussions they might have within the policing fraternity and their careers and so on. So this is something that needs to be understood, that this is something that is very much there. And in terms of the problems within this, with this actually being filmed in terms of happening to a black individual, I think the problem that the people are seeing, that once this goes out, that with any kind of injustice that is going to be coming into the forefront and going to be legislated in this way, then inevitably things that are targeted at minorities, be they Arab or black or whatever, in this case, the instance you're talking about is the a black individual being targeted in this way. What people here have recognized from the white community in France is that this is could be something that will give police powers that are beyond something that they are prepared to accept. But we need to understand the racial element that exists within this context, and in particular within the context of France. We're talking about a country that is deeply racist in terms of its attitudes towards people, institutionally racist in many of its institutions, and that's something that is put out there, and it's something that comes up regularly in terms of how that institutional racism is also impacting on the racist attitudes of ordinary people in the country. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized and said for what it is, that that is what the problem is and that is what's going on. So there is different layers, if you like, to that.
Well, Daniel, in your perspective, how common is police brutality in France anyway?
It's very hard to answer that kind of question because evidence is very hard to obtain. There's a code of silence among police officers, and very often a criminal case boils down to an individual cop's word against an individual defendant's word. So it's difficult to prove and it's difficult to know. It's kind of the phenomenon is kind of in a black box.
With that being said, I mean, wouldn't the government know to begin with that there's definitely going to be backlash in suggesting something like that that would not be in the benefit of the average citizen?
Well, because the government thinks that maybe in balance it'll be politically beneficial to the government. That, in other words, that more citizens will approve of this policy than disapprove of this policy. Yes, a certain vocal element is taken to the street, in my opinion, to protest this move towards police authoritarianism, but they're not the entire electorate. And so therefore, some portion of the electorate may approve of these measures, may approve of a tougher police response. That is Macron's gamble. That's what he's trying to do. So we don't know how it will play out. Certainly in the United States, police violence is a massive problem, completely out of control. The citizen, many people are up in arms over it, but many people support a tougher police response. So this is what the political struggle is all about.
Indeed. Well, Raza, there have been growing complaints by many French of increasing surveillance by security forces in the country. Why is it, on the one hand, the government increases surveillance techniques against the people, and on the other hand, Paris doesn't want journalists to keep watch over police?
I think in terms of the direction that they want to go in, that they want that surveillance to be something that they can use and weaponize for their own political ends. It's not about something where the police should be a force, an institution that actually works for the community in terms of making sure that policing takes place in a sensible and a way that brings confidence into the community. But when the state goes about these kind of things, where they increase surveillance, where they reduce the ability of the ordinary citizen to challenge the police, even by filming some brutality or whatever that might be taking place, then what you're doing is increasing, as I said before, the idea of creating a police state and continuing down that route. And when we talk about one of the three phrases that is often associated with France, and it's something that is very much part of the publicity relations exercise that France carries out internationally about liberté, as it calls it, it's quite, you know, I think it's a bit of a joke that they dare to say that about anything that happens in any other country around the world in terms of policing, considering the direction that they're actually going in. And I think that one of the first things that needs to be said about this, that France is a police state. It's not about liberté, fraternité, et cetera, et cetera. It is about reducing the rights of individuals and citizens. And in answer to your question, it's about weaponizing surveillance and for it to be used as a tool when it suits the French political establishment, whichever strand of it, it may well be interested in a particular direction that it wants to go in. And so it's all part of that same, those same machinations.
Daniel, your take on what Reza just said, I mean, because, yes, France likes to brag about its democratic roots and having liberty for all of its citizens. Has it simply become a slogan with the reality being something very far from the truth?
Unquestionably. I mean, yes. I mean, that's sort of the story for much of modern French history. But yeah, I mean, France, as a country, it's a large urban country with a swelling underclass, many of them immigrants or racial minorities. There's crime. There's a war on drugs, whose impact in terms of undermining civil liberties can't be underestimated, can't be overestimated. I mean, Yeah, I mean, France is subject to the same authoritarian tendencies of every other advanced industrial state on Earth, including the U.S., Britain, Germany, etc. And they, all of them, are drifting in a more and more overt authoritarian direction as the social crisis, the economic crisis, intensifies. That crisis is already acute. I think it's going to get worse and worse in the coming period. And these governments are responding by unleashing the police, adopting more punitive measures. That seems to be the direction that they are heading in.
Reza, your take, same question. Do you think that, what's the reasons in your perspective that countries like France is going towards a more authoritarian way?
Yeah, I mean, we need to, I mean, if we come across from France, across the English Channel, and come to Britain itself, we need to understand that what was pejoratively, derogatively looked at institutionally in terms of what the police had actually done in terms of infiltrating and abusing the communities and so on, in the way that surveillance was actually carried out, in the way that abuses took place within that policing context. What we are now seeing is that police are being asked and told that they will be protected under law by laws being passed which will allow them to carry out these actions, and they'll be protected. So it's one law that will be applied to the police, there will be another law that will be applied to the ordinary person. And what we are seeing is that as this direction actually continues, the idea of more and more countries and more ideas of the police state being entrenched in different sections of the law, the establishment, the institution, the more problems ordinary people are actually going to have. It's going to start off by targeting racial minorities. It will start off by targeting people who are, who have some kind of communities that are disadvantaged and so on. And inevitably, as it happens with, and there are plenty of examples, going back to the terrorism laws and so on that were started at the beginning of this century in the UK, which have gone on to target ordinary people, the wider white community. And this is something that is very much going to be happening here. And this culture stems from this idea that the end justifies the means. The principles are not even being paid lip service to, that philosophy is not something that is acceptable.
Daniel, do you think at the end of the day that this law is going to be implemented? Because as we're saying, there has been a lot of blowback, but as you also said, there are those who actually support it. So your assessment at the end of the day, will it pass or not?
My assessment is that it will pass, that Macron thinks it's very important. Macron thinks he's got to show that he has a strong hand, that he will not be cowed, that he's resolute. And that he is—he's determined to hold off a challenge from the radical right. So I think in the end it will become law.
And Reza, your prognosis, near future of France? We're going to see a continual deterioration of rights for citizens and others?
I think that's inevitable. I think that's—I mean, if you chart it, before the idea was that the concept of liberty and so on was actually talked about and brandished about around the world. It's something that is being done in France to actually keep on emphasizing these concepts and so on. But actually what has been going on, if you chart the history, and it's just not just in France, it's happening in Britain as well, in terms of what the rights are going to be, what people can and can't do, and how the spaces in which people can actually express themselves and have legitimate freedoms to actually be able to express discontent and to be able to protest, all of those things are being squeezed so that the net effect is the reduction of people to be able to say something, and that is very much reminiscent of a police state and fascism. And I think, unfortunately, while they might call it democracies, that's the direction that things are actually going in.
And it seems, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. On that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Daniel Lazar out of New York, journalist and author, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. Appreciate you both being with us. And as always, nice to have you with us on another debate, and hope that you will join us right here, same time tomorrow.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Islamic Revolution, solution to crisis of spirituality. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the second day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. Today we are going to touch upon another important feature of the Islamic revolution, namely the solution to the crisis of modern man through revival of spirituality. Stay tuned, please. One of the most important features of the Islamic revolution is that it triumphed by reliance on religion. This was while Marxism, as a prevalent ideology in those years, described religion as the opium of masses and justifier of oppression of rulers. The Islamic revolution proved that, depending on the teachings of Islam, a nation can stage uprising against the tyranny of rulers and bring about freedom and social justice. The Islamic revolution revived religion and spirituality at a time that contemporary human being had been alienated from himself through technology and consequences of technology. Of course, the Islamic revolution has not been opposite to technology and sciences, but it has tried to show the true picture of technology and ills of modernism. Experts maintain that although modernism has brought achievements for mankind, it has deprived him from many natural needs, especially spirituality and inclination to worshipping the source of creation. Some experts believe that the modern man's crises are of two categories. The first consists of those crises which are the result of man's opposition with himself and God. The second group includes those crises which stem from man's opposition with the society and the world. Opposition with oneself and God causes crisis of identity and makes man totally isolated. Today, the dominance of instrumental rationality has marginalized human emotions, and human being has failed to create a balance between reasoning and emotions. Materialism, hedonism, and utilitarianism have led human being to skepticism. This has ultimately led to nihilism, which is manifested in suicide and myriads of social ills. The lack of balance in individuals' relations with the society and the environment has caused a lot of crises. Excessive enjoyment of nature as the source of man's welfare has led to severe environmental crises and has put man in the brink of annihilation. The generation gap has intensified in various societies, and family, as the main unit and trench of social life, has been put at the threshold of disintegration. Moreover, excessive pursuit of carnal pleasures and extravagant consumerism have made human life far from modernism. Such an individual will not think of his ultimate fate and won't have any ideal. This has led to psychological turmoil, which in turn leads to crimes, divorce, suicide, and a plethora of other ills. The current modernism has resulted in depression and dissatisfaction of the individual towards life. Now the question which has occupied the minds of pundits and researchers is this: why have progresses in various sciences been unable to overcome this magnitude of crisis? And what is the solution? The Islamic revolution emerged in the current crisis-hit world as a novel pattern for human life. One of the outstanding features of this revolution has been the revival of spirituality. Thus, Imam Khomeini was indeed the reviver of spirituality in the 20th century. He introduced Islam as a perfect religion which pays attention to the minutest dimensions of mankind and meets each and every need of him. The Imam strongly believed that Islam is the most suitable model for arrangement of human life and setting up a rule due to its simultaneous emphasis on intellect and religion. Imam Khomeini said, Islam is the source of human salvation. Islam has come for building human being. It has come unlike ungodly elements to take human beings to light. Elsewhere in his remarks, he said, we should try to invite people to spirituality and Islamic morality. Many might think that material welfare and having properties or real estate and the like will bring salvation for human being. But this is a mistake that man makes. Imam Khomeini also wrote in his last testament, we and our nation have the honor of following a religion which has rescued Quranic realities that thoroughly speak of unity among Muslims and even mankind from graves and as the greatest savior has salvaged mankind from the fetters that have been tied around his feet, hands and heart, to drag him toward destruction and slavery of ungodly rulers. Imam Khomeini maintained that revival of spirituality is not limited to the individual life, and it includes the whole ruling system. It should be manifested in the conduct of officials in every section. The Imam illustrated the principles and structure of popular religions, which differs a lot from the liberal democracy preached by the West and is in fact more democratic than any democratic rule that mankind has experienced in the West so far. He used to warn the officials against being plunged in materialism and seeking worldly pleasures as the cause of decline of the Islamic rule. Imam Khomeini considered achievement of freedom, independence, justice, progress, and building of civilization alongside spirituality and morality as the main message of the Islamic Revolution. He strongly believed that development and progress without morality and spirituality would lead to ungodly rule. He was boastful of defending the oppressed and downtrodden throughout the world and fought against oppressors. His thoughts had impacted thinkers like Michel Foucault too. The French thinker was a serious critic of modernity and maintained that modernity is based on the separation of progress from morality. Foucault opined that the Islamic Revolution has proved the failure of modernity. He said that the Islamic Revolution has filled the spiritual vacuum and breathed a new spirit in the body of human societies. He maintained that the Western civilization has denoted mankind of spirituality and genuine identity. He said that the Islamic Revolution posed the greatest challenge against the Western civilization and shook its foundations.
Good morning.
of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.